Okay, good morning, everybody. It's about 2:31, April 30th, Wednesday, last lecture of the week. And I'm just going to turn a couple of these lights down. Oh, that one I like. That one I like. This one. All right, so let's take a look at the schedule over on the right-hand slide. So we said it's the 30th today. Ah, good. It is the 30th. And we're going to finish up blood vessels and get through lymphatic system today, more than likely. And we'll probably be right on schedule after that. So when is your last test? It's on the 21st of May. We're almost in May. So how many weeks is that? 1, 2, 3 weeks away. Okay, but since it's 3 weeks away, we have what? 2.5 weeks worth of lecture left in the class. So print out all your study guides, start working on them. Make sure you understand what the scope of the project is that you have to learn before the final. You don't have to study at all right now, but at least get an understanding, right, of what you need to do. All right, so blood vessels. We talked a lot about blood vessels last time. So we talked about the difference between arteries and veins. So you know what? We should probably define really quick. What is an artery? Yeah, it takes blood away from the heart. And you have some really nicely color-coded figures in your textbook. Sometimes blood vessels are colored blue, representing low oxygen. Sometimes vessels are colored red, meaning high oxygen. Can you ever think of a case where you have a vein that is red, which means high in oxygen? Can you ever have a vein that's high in oxygen? And what's the name? Yeah, the pulmonary vein. So veins coming back from the lungs are high in oxygen. Even though it's a vein, that's a vein because it's bringing blood back to the heart, right? If it's coming back from the lungs, it's got to be high in oxygen. So that is a red vein. That's part of the pulmonary circulation. Systemic circulation, remember, is the opposite. Systemic circulation, arteries are red and veins are blue. Pulmonary circulation, arteries are blue, veins are red. So just think of them as being opposite to each other. It can be confusing, so you got to make sure you have that straight in your mind. All right, and what were the three main kinds of blood vessels? Three main kinds. Artery, vein, and capillary. Yeah, so you just told me very correctly that an artery takes blood away from the heart, a vein brings blood back to the heart. But what's the function of a capillary?
Exchange. Yeah,
it's thin, right? It's thin, so it allows for exchange. All right, so that's the important functional characteristic of a capillary. That's the only place where exchange can take place. All right, so don't forget, the sign-in sheet is going around someplace. And, oh, I did forget, any special news from SI? No special news, just continuing on like normal. Good. Okay. So let's start with the pulmonary circulation. And I really like that diagram. It's not in this particular chapter, but that very first picture in the cardiovascular chapter. Remember, has the whole circulation. Oh, wow, that's such a good chapter, such a good figure. You know what? I'm going to try and open it up. I forgot I wanted to show that one. That would be in the heart. Okay. Oh, wrong one. Heart. This one right here. Yeah, so you should just have this one burned in your memory. All right, so here it's a really simple illustration, but it tells you almost everything you want to know. It tells you how many sides does the heart have? How many chambers does the heart have? How many valves does it have? Yeah, it has all that information. And since the heart has two sides, then you kind of know how many circulations there are. There are two, and you got to know their names, systemic and pulmonary, right? And it's all on this slide, and it's even color-coded so you know what blood is oxygenated and where it is relatively deoxygenated. Okay, so here is that pulmonary circulation from the right ventricle to the left atrium. Systemic is from the left ventricle back to the right atrium. And it shows all the different kinds of blood vessels. Here is, I see an arrow going away from the heart. That's an artery. Here's an arrow going back to the heart. That's a vein. Here is a red blood vessel with an arrow going back to the heart. What is that?
Vein.
That's a vein because it's going back to the heart. And that's an example, right, of a red one. Great. Okay, so I guess what did I want to show you? I wanted to show you capillaries, right? So there are capillaries in the systemic circulation, capillaries in the lungs, and that's where exchange takes place. So in the lungs, oxygen goes in, obviously because the vein is red, carbon dioxide leaves. And then that oxygen is delivered to the tissue, so in this in the systemic capillaries, oxygen leaves, and CO2 enters, that's why it becomes blue, right? So don't forget, their pulmonary and systemic circulations are really different. They're pretty much opposite of each other. Okay. So if you got a nice picture of a lung, let's see if I can find a nice picture of a lung someplace. Okay. I probably can't find a picture of a lung. If I run into it, I'll make sure that I quiz you on that. So blood vessels in the lungs, would you guess should be systemic or pulmonary? Most of them. Pulmonary, yeah. So if you see a blue vessel in a lung, what would you want to call that? An artery or a vein? I know it's a little, you got to think. A blue vessel in the lungs, blue vessel in pulmonary circulation. Artery or a vein? Okay. In pulmonary circulation, a blue vessel is going to be an artery. And the red vessel in the lung is going to be a vein because it's going back to the heart and it has picked up oxygen because there's capillaries in the lungs. Yeah, so I know even though we go over that 100 times, it's still kind of, it's difficult to appreciate. Oh, I know why I wanted to show you that one picture, because we're talking about this slide right here. Right, so pulmonary trunk is the first vessel coming out of the right ventricle, right past the pulmonary pulmonary valve, and then the pulmonary trunk bifurcates very early on into the right and left pulmonary artery, and remember that's deoxygenated blood that's going to the lungs to pick up oxygen. And the right pulmonary artery dives right underneath the arch of the aorta. So that's an interesting thing. But probably the most interesting thing that you should be aware of is that the pulmonary trunk is that first great artery that you see coming from the anterior side of the body, from the anterior side of the heart. So when we do a dissection on a fetal pig and open up their rib cage and cut down and get to the heart, we're going to see a big, powerful artery right there. And guess what that artery is going to be, the first one that you find. It's going to look like the aorta, but it is really the pulmonary artery. To find the aorta, you got to go, behind. You got to go behind that pulmonary artery. Okay. So that's pretty good for pulmonary circulation. Systemic, as we just said, starts, you could think of that starting with the left ventricle, going through the aorta, right, then systemic capillaries, and then returning to the heart via the vena cava. All right, and what chamber does the vena cava empty into?
Right.
It's the right atrium. Yeah, you should have that nice picture in your mind. Okay, so let's look at some divisions of the aorta. We go over a lot of this stuff in lab, so I'm not going to take too much time with this, but maybe a little bit. All right, so here is the aorta, and we just see a little piece of it. We see the piece from the base of the heart ascending in this direction, so we're going to call this the ascending aorta, and then it's going to curve around, a nice hairpin turn, 180 degrees. This is the arch of the aorta, and then after the arch, it proceeds inferiorly, and we call that the descending aorta. All right, in lab, we're going to see that the diaphragm is right about here, and the aorta actually goes through the diaphragm and then passes through the abdominal cavity. So we're going to have a descending aorta in the abdominal cavity. We're going to call that the abdominal aorta. The descending aorta in the thoracic cavity is what we call the thoracic aorta. So sometimes, right, just like cavities, you can break down into smaller cavities. All right. I think I have a pretty good picture of that someplace. All right, so let's zoom in. I'll lose my arrow when I zoom in, but let's just zoom in anyway. Zoom, 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 zoom. All right, so here is ascending. Here's the arch. Here's the descending aorta. Oh, that goes right up against the apex of the heart. So then that becomes it's a descending, but it's the abdominal division, right? And then that goes all the way, it goes all the way down. A little hard to see. That goes all the way down to, this is good. Okay, so here is abdominal aorta. It goes all the way down to this point right here, and then it bifurcates. And then when a blood vessel bifurcates, we have to change its name because it's going to a different part of the body. So this is what we call the common iliac, right? Common iliac. And then that's going to bifurcate once again to an internal iliac artery and an external iliac. And then it's going to become the femoral artery. And what else do I want you to know? For arteries, lower limbs, popliteal. Okay, popliteal arteries behind the knee. All right, so I just see a little shadow of one. We're actually looking through the knee, so it's posterior. It's in your posterior knee. That's the popliteal. All right, so you got common iliac, external iliac, femoral, popliteal. Maybe if that's confusing, maybe just draw it out as a straight line, okay, and put some bifurcations in there, and then you're ready to go to know different parts. Yeah. Ah, it's behind the heart, so we can't really see it, right? So you're talking about the descending part of the aorta in the thoracic region. Do you have lab this afternoon? No. Oh, okay. I show people, maybe I can find this really fast. Let's see what happens here. Why can't I get to it? I have to look at that sometime later. Okay, I see a bunch of mobile apps, but I don't want a mobile app. I want something that runs on this right here. Wow, I'm going to have to come back to it later. Okay, it's really simple to get to, but I get to it through Chrome. Maybe I'll launch Chrome really fast. This is good. Okay, so we get to pick female or male, right? Male or female? Go ahead, pick. Male. Okay. So here is male coming. Yeah. To the screen. All right. So there's a male. Looks. Oh, he's looking at us. Okay. It just doesn't have a really big, powerful graphics card in here. All right. So we see integument. We can get rid of the integument and look at some deeper structures like muscles, right? So here's some muscles. And we can get rid of the muscles, dissect those away, and we can see some of the deeper things like the skeleton, for instance, and visceral organs. But we're interested in the heart, right? We're interested in the heart. So maybe let's move this down a little bit, and then let's zoom in. And I just want a nice anterior view like this. And where is that heart at? Yeah. Okay, here it is right here. And it's behind the sternum and the rib cage. So let's get rid of some of these bones as well. We don't need to see these bones. And now what do you see? That nice heart right there, right? Okay. And as a matter of fact, we can get rid of some of these other organs like this. And maybe get rid of some nerves. We don't want nerves in there. We don't want that kind of tissue in there. So now we just have the vascular system. And so let's really zoom into the heart because that's what we're going to be interested in. So I'm going to come back to here. All right, but I want to get rid of some of these other blood vessels, like the intercostal blood vessels. Let's cut that one away. And cut away how do I go back? Cut away these intercostals like that. All right, so what? Can I get rid of that? No. Okay, that's gone away as much as possible. All right, so what part of the heart is this here? Apex, and here is the base. And then what is this thing that kind of curls around the heart? Anterior longitudinal sulcus. Yeah, so for sure this is the anterior side of the heart. The most anterior blood vessel on the heart is the
pulmonary
trunk. And if you click on this, it should tell you, pulmonary trunk, that's nice. Okay. All right, and you can see then the pulmonary arteries here is the left, over here is the right, going underneath the aorta. But your question was, where is that descending aorta at in the thoracic region? Well, remember, the diaphragm is right here, and we could reveal it by messing around, but just believe me, it's right here. Later on at home, you can find it. So here's ascending, here's the arch. We're going to take a look at some of these blood vessels, but what about that descending region of the aorta? I said it's right here down to the diaphragm. So I tell you what, let's wing this around. Let's take a look at the posterior side. And so here is the arch. Right here is the thoracic division of the descending aorta. So that's pretty handy to see. All right, so I'm going to keep this window active so I can refer to this every once in a while. Okay. All right, you have to know some blood vessels coming off the arch of the aorta. This first one right here, we see, goes, all right, just a little ways in the thorax, and then it bifurcates into an artery that takes blood to the head and another artery that takes blood to the arm, upper appendage, right? So things toward the head are what we call cephalic. Things toward the arm are what we call brachial. So this region right here that is taking blood to both the head and the arm, this is the brachiocephalic artery. Right, if we look over here, can we see it? Sorry. Yeah, I can see it, sort of. But I've got a vein in the way. But that's no problem, because what can we do? We can get out a scalpel and take it away. Right, we can take that away, too. All right, so now I see these three vessels. So here's the brachiocephalic, and then here is the common carotid. On the right side, here is the right subclavian, which matches up with this diagram, except on zygote, you can turn it around to get a better perspective. All right, so brachiocephalic, common carotid, subclavian. Now, the next branch off the arch of the aorta is the left common carotid. And the next branch is going to be the left subclavian. So the brachiocephalic is one artery doing the job of the next two. Right? It's just the next two. And sometimes these next two are really close together, and even at the origin right here, they're kind of just the same artery. But let's consider them separate arteries. Okay. All right, so then let's continue with the arm. So here's the subclavian. Right? That should be pretty easy to see. And then in the axillary region, we're going to have the axillary artery. And then in the arm, that's going to become the brachial. Right? And it's the same vessel, but it's just in a different part of the body. So we give a different name so we know where it is located in the body. And then it's going to go into the forearm, and of course we're going to see the radial artery matching up with the radius bone, which is lateral. Here's the thumb, and then here's the ulnar artery. And we can see some palmar arches right here as well. All right, I think I maybe have palmar arches in the lab manual. All right, so which one do you use to count somebody's heartbeats to figure out what their heart rate is? Have you ever done that with anybody? Yourself? Yeah, you turn your hand over, so it's sort of an anatomic position, and where do you put your two fingers? Okay, on your wrist, but where? Right in the middle? No. On the inside? Medial or lateral? The best place is lateral. So sometimes we call that the radial pulse because we're feeling the pressure in the radius artery. Sometimes we call that the distal pulse because why? It's far away from some center location in your body. But, of course, you can have a distal pulse in other places, so you might want to be specific and say radial pulse, and everybody will know what you're talking about. All right, so that's the upper appendage. We went over the lower appendage. Let's look at the abdominal aorta in particular. All right, so let me see what kind of illustrations do we have that are really, 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 really nice. Maybe this one right here. Yeah, I still like the other one. We'll come back to this one in a second, but I still like this one. So let's zoom in. Come on down. Okay, so descending aorta in the abdominal cavity. I want you to break these arteries up, and there's not a whole lot of them, into two different types. Sometimes they come off as a single branch. Sometimes they come off as a what we call a paired branch. All right, so here is a single branch right here. And a single branch brings blood to an organ that you only have one copy of. Can you think of an organ that you only have one of in your body? Like what? You guys are thinking, we haven't gotten to that part of anatomy yet. But for instance, stomach would be one. You only have one stomach. You have one spleen, got one liver, right? Okay, and one small intestine, one large intestine. So those organs get blood from what we call an unpaired branch off the aorta. And where do we find them? The first one is the celiac trunk. There's just one right there. Right, there's just one. And then it bifurcates very early on to a splenic and a hepatic and a gastric. Right, but this very first one, right below the diaphragm, that's a single branch, called that the celiac trunk. Then we descend a little bit, and then here's another single branch coming off. That's the superior mesenteric. So that's going to intestines. And then if we proceed further down, we see the inferior mesenteric. So that's easy to know, right? Superior mesenteric, inferior, that's really easy to see. Just a single branch. But there are some arteries that come off in pairs. And here we see that, of course, you have two kidneys. So it's got to come off as a paired branch. So here is a renal artery. Here's one on the other side. And there's also an adrenal artery that actually comes off a little bit superior to the renal arteries. Not shown on this diagram. Maybe on that other one it is. And then this one here, right, it comes off as a paired branch, and it goes here, goes here, goes here, goes here, goes all the way down to here and in here. Let's pretend this is a guy. This is going to a gonad, so we call these the gonadal arteries, right and left gonadal arteries. If it's a female, then of course these gonadal arteries would just go down to an ovary, which is about in this location here and here. Right, those are the gonadal. So that's really what you have to know about the branches off the abdominal aorta. And I'm not stressing any branches coming off the thoracic aorta. But you believe it's behind the heart? You believe it's back there? Yeah, because I showed you in that fancy program that we could turn things around. Right over here. Where was that? Right here. So here's that thoracic division. Okay. And as a matter of fact, you could trace all these other arteries, okay, in here as well. This is probably the superior mesenteric. Here's the celiac trunk. So if this is superior mesenteric and I click on it, click, 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 right, it should say superior mesenteric. And what does it say? Ah, superior mesenteric. Right, and then we can go back and you can even trace the gonadal arteries. Right, this is probably a gonadal artery right here going all the way down to a gonad. And who did we pick? I forget, male or female. But you know what? We could figure it out by bringing everything back. And, oh, okay, so that's a male. All right, but you could trace it in female as well. All right, so where are we? So we got paired branches, unpaired branches, pelvic arteries. Yeah, we talked about the iliac already, external, internal, femoral. Okay, veins. Well, let me just say something about this vascular anastomosis. All right, so a vascular anastomosis is where blood vessels bifurcate and then join back together again. It forms a network. Anastomose really means when blood vessels come back together. So arteries typically bifurcate, veins typically anastomose, right, because they join back together. And some of these are very complex. They form a network, kind of like a nerve plexus. What's the really nice thing about a nerve plexus? Yeah, it's like a backup pathway for nerve impulses, right? If one of the pathways gets damaged, then that nerve impulse can go into the plexus and eventually find its way to some important organ that should not lose innervation. That's the beauty of a plexus. Same thing for a vascular anastomosis. It just allows blood to take different routes to get to the same place. If it's an important organ, for instance, like the brain or other parts of your body. All right, so that's the function of a vascular anastomosis. All right, so veins, in particular the superior vena cava. superior vena cava. We got rid of it on that zygote diagram, but let's go back to here. All right, so here are veins. And fortunately, most of the veins in your body are named after the arteries that they course with, that you find right next to in the body. There's only a couple that have a little bit different name. Okay, and probably you might think of an artery in the neck as a carotid, common carotid, but the veins in the neck are the jugular veins. So that's a little bit different. So I see an external jugular and an internal jugular. So external drains blood from outside the cranium. The internal drains blood from inside the cranium, namely, right, the brain. What else? Well, in the leg, okay, we do have iliac veins, common iliac. We do have a saphenous vein that's medial, right, that comes down from the femoral vein. So I think that's pretty good. Veins in the arm, right? This one that's most lateral, we call that the cephalic vein, and it's more toward your head than any of these other veins. Then we have the brachial vein in the middle, and then the basilic vein, which is medial. So we got cephalic, brachial, and basilic vein. That's a little bit different compared to arteries. Okay, so I think that's all I want to talk about in terms of the gross anatomy of arteries and veins, because we covered them pretty extensively in lab. Which takes us to something that's really important, and that is special circulations in the body. And we're going to look at a portal circulation. So what the heck is a portal circulation? Well, what does a typical circulation look like? We can use this as a model, or even better yet, here's a really good model of a circulatory pattern. You see one artery bringing blood from the heart, you see one vein bringing blood back to the heart, and in between, I see a capillary bed. Now, in this illustration, how many capillary beds do you see?
Two.
Okay. I see red and blue, but you know what? That's all one capillary bed right here. All right, so there really is only one capillary bed. So this is a typical and very common circulatory pattern. Artery, one capillary bed, and then a vein. In certain places in the body, we don't see that pattern. It's modified. We have an artery bringing blood to a capillary, and then all those capillaries anastomose to form one other vessel, it's like a vein, that goes to a second capillary bed. And then the vein takes blood back to the heart. So in a portal circulation, there are two capillary beds back to back, not just one. Here are some examples of where you would find them. The hepatic portal system, in the nephron we're going to find one, and we actually saw one when we look at the endocrine chapter, the hypothalamo-hypophyseal portal blood vessel. Right, that interconnected capillaries in the hypothalamus and capillaries in the anterior pituitary. That's a portal blood vessel. So the portal blood vessel connects those two capillary beds back together, but it acts pretty much like a vein. I don't think we have a picture of one in here, just a description. Oh, no, we got a picture right here. All right, so here we have an artery taking blood away from the heart, and it's red. So is this systemic or pulmonary circulation? Systemic, right, because it's high in oxygen. Arteries are high in oxygen and systemic. Here is an arteriole, feeds a capillary bed. Something can enter because exchange is allowed. Maybe a hormone in the hypothalamus will enter this region, and then these capillaries anastomose into this single vessel that looks like a vein, but it's a portal vein because there's a second capillary bed here. And what's the function of a capillary bed once again? Either this one or this one, it allows for exchange, right? So a hormone can enter the first capillary bed and leave the second. This would be a really good example of hormones entering the blood in the hypothalamus being delivered directly to the anterior pituitary. Right. This illustration right here shows a little bit different circulation, but the same thing. There are capillaries around intestines, right? And these intestines pick up nutrients as well as toxins, whatever we have in our diet. And if that were to enter your body, then, well, you'd be intoxicated. You'd be damaged somehow by those harmful compounds. So the arteries around the intestines and anastomose into a single blood vessel, which then goes to another capillary bed in the liver, and those toxic compounds can leave and be toxified by liver cells before they return to the circulation. So again, a portal blood vessel interconnects two capillary beds back to back, and then from the liver, right, then the final vein, the hepatic vein, takes it back to the inferior vena cava. Okay. So this is like a special delivery system, a door-to-door delivery system. Here is the first door. Things enter. Here's the second door. It can leave. All right. So that's handy. That's a portal system. So here is a slide, right, that shows this portal system, hepatic portal system, in just a little bit more detail. So we have the gastrointestinal tract. We have like the mesenteric artery, gastric artery, inferior mesenteric artery going to all the digestive organs in the body, and there are capillaries there, so things that are in our diet, whatever we eat, will enter the circulatory system through those capillary beds, right, in the stomach and small intestine, and those compounds don't go directly to the body. They have to go to the liver first to be detoxified. So these first capillary beds, anastomose, right, and form the hepatic portal vein, and then that hepatic portal vein takes blood to the liver, and there's capillaries there. Blood can flow out of those capillaries and toxic compounds. The cells of the liver will detoxify those compounds and then return the blood to the usual circulation that you're used to, namely what, the inferior vena cava. Right, and inferior vena cava goes back to the right atrium. All right, so that's a portal circulation. So just remember, two capillary beds for a portal circulation with a portal vein in between them. Question.
So on the second test,
yes.
The way you call it, the liver will put away the waste product before that negotiation gets in the blood.
Okay, so you're asking me, how do these toxic compounds get out of the blood into the liver through this capillary?
Why do you need to?
Oh, well, if these toxic compounds that get absorbed from your digestive tract, instead of going to the liver for detoxification, if they go to the brain or if they go to the heart, they can have a deleterious effect. They can hurt the brain. They can hurt the heart. So these compounds go through the liver first. The liver detoxifies them, maybe breaks them down, maybe adds something to them, maybe destroys them altogether, and then the heart and brain aren't affected by those chemicals. Okay, so that's the deal with that. So that's very adaptive. Fetal circulation. We're going to look at that in lab, but we haven't had time. So probably we should look at that a little bit here in lecture. And you have some really good illustrations in your textbook, and we have a nice fetal model. Okay. So, you know what? Before we get there, let me come back over here to this slide. Right? Really nice slide. So this slide shows the pulmonary circulation and systemic circulation, right? So if we're going to look at the lungs, right, and here's an artery in the pulmonary circulation. Is this high in oxygen or low? It's low because it's blue. But is this an artery or a vein? Is this a blue artery or a blue vein? It's a blue artery, right? That's really characteristic of the pulmonary circulation, which is opposite compared to the systemic. Arteries are red in systemic circulation or high. Right, in the pulmonary circulation, then the pulmonary veins, you know this is a vein because it's bringing blood back to the heart, has picked up oxygen, so it's nice bright red. Okay, so when we think of the fetal circulation, okay, we're going to use that model in our mind to figure it out. All right, so here is a fetus. It hasn't been born, right? That's the definition of a fetus, a person that hasn't been born yet. But it's pretty much all developed. I see a whole bunch of organs. I see lungs and heart, liver, kidneys. All right, I see a nice vena cava, aorta, all that. But So this fetus is in utero, and since it's in utero, is it breathing air? It is not breathing air. But it needs oxygen, right? It really needs some kind of functional lung to bring oxygen into its body. So where does it get oxygen from? It gets oxygen from the mother, right? From the maternal circulation. And where that happens is in the placenta, right? So the placenta is right here, and it receives blood supply from the fetus. It also receives blood supply from the mother. That's really an interesting organ because it's the only organ I know of that is actually made from two different individuals. It's part fetus and part mom that come together to form this really interesting organ. All right, so here we have some blood vessels, and we can see that it's taking blood away from the heart, right? Taking blood away from the heart. So is this an artery or a vein?
Artery.
Artery, yeah, and I see two of them. And it's in the umbilical cord, so these are umbilical arteries. Now, are these going to be relatively high in oxygen or low? You want to think of the placenta as being like the lung for the fetus. What about in the adult? Pulmonary arteries are low in oxygen or high?
Low.
Low, that's right, because they're going to the lungs to pick up oxygen. So these umbilical arteries are low in oxygen, and therefore, okay, I don't see them colored bright red. I don't know what color you see them. Do you see them pink or something? I don't know. Okay. All right, so these are the umbilical arteries going through the umbilical cord to the placenta. And there are capillaries in the placenta for exchange. CO2 goes into the maternal circulation. Oxygen comes from the maternal circulation into the fetal circulation. And then there's a single vessel that brings blood back to the fetus, right, toward the heart. What do we call a vessel bringing blood toward the heart? A vein. So here's the umbilical vein, bright red, right, because it's coming back from the placenta after it has picked up oxygen. All right, so we got umbilical veins, and then here is the liver, and the fetus really doesn't have a functioning liver, but that's okay because the fetus can rely on the maternal liver as well. Right, so toxins will leave the fetal circulation into the maternal, and then the mom detoxifies things. So blood does not have to go into the liver, so it takes this little bypass. Doesn't go into the liver, takes this little bypass. We call that the ductus venosus. So a duct is just a patent blood vessel. And then that blood is dumped into the vena cava. Here's the inferior vena cava. So this is a little strange because here we have nice oxygenated blood mixing with deoxygenated blood. And that's just the way it is in the fetus. All right, so now here we have a mixture of blood of different kinds. It looks all like the same color, but they probably should have picked a different. Is it a different color than here? It looks the same to me. All right. So inferior vena cava, where does blood go next? Where does vena cava bring blood? Either superior or inferior, same place, would be the?
Right atrium.
The right atrium. So here is the right atrium. The blood returns to the right atrium. And then it would be pumped into the right ventricle, and from the right ventricle, it gets pumped into the pulmonary trunk, which would take it to the lungs. But should a lot of blood be going to the fetal lungs? Not necessarily, because there's no oxygen in the lungs, right? So that would be a lot of wasted effort. So there's a couple things that take place. So blood that enters the right atrium can go through a hole, what do we call a hole in anatomy? A foramen, can go through a foramen in the interatrial septum. So blood can go directly from the right atrium into the left atrium, and when it does, what is it bypassing? It's bypassing the pulmonary circulation, it's bypassing the lungs directly through the foramen ovale. So it kind of looks a little oval. Foramen ovale in the interatrial septum. All right, and then it just joins the systemic circulation, and here we see it in the aorta. All right, so that's one way blood can bypass the lungs. Here's another way. Some blood does get into the right ventricle, get pumped into the pulmonary trunk, and it's on its way to the lungs, but remember, it doesn't need to go to the lungs. So here is a special passageway from the pulmonary artery directly into the aorta. See if I can find it on this light. All right, here. Ah, I'm beginning to see it. You see it right here? Okay, in the fetus, we call that the ductus arteriosus, taking blood from the pulmonary circulation right back to the systemic circulation, bypassing the lungs. And in the adult, right? This closes down, but it remains as a little vestigial piece of your body. We call that the ligamentum arteriosum. Some of you that had lab already have found the ligamentum arteriosum on a heart, right? And now you know where it comes from, because it was the ductus arteriosus in the fetus. But it shouldn't be a patent blood vessel. It should not be an operating blood vessel in the adult, because then, in the adult, blood won't be going to the lungs, right? And that's not a good case for an adult, because we no longer have a placenta. All right, so the placenta, I forgot to mention that. The placenta doesn't become anything in the adult, like all these other structures do become a little bit of something. All right, and when somebody's born, this foraminal valley closes over, so blood can't go back and forth, so blood starts to go to the lungs. In the adult, right, it just becomes a depression that we call the fossa ovalis. All right, so these things are pretty important. You should know where they are and what they get converted into, right, and for what these structures in the fetus become in the adult, like the ligamentum venosum, for the ductus venosus taking blood away from the liver, and this umbilical vein, right? Nice bright red, reminds you of a pulmonary vein, becomes the ligamentum teres. When we start to study the liver, you're gonna see that ligamentum teres is there, and it comes because of the umbilical vein. All right, so is that kind of helpful for you to see, to understand why these umbilical arteries are low in oxygen and why the umbilical vein is high in oxygen? Because what organ system in the adult are you going to think of? Or what circulation? The pulmonary circulation, right? It's just nicely modeled just like the pulmonary circulation, because the placenta is acting like the lungs for the fetus. Okay, so that's the fetal circulation. All right, so now we're done with the vascular chapter, and even the heart chapter. All right, but I want to go back to this illustration right here. So I just see the two circulations, systemic and pulmonary. So for the systemic circulation, which is very high pressure, gets to a capillary, and that high pressure in these blood vessels forces a lot of fluid out of the cardiovascular system, out through the capillaries. Not only does oxygen diffuse out, and carbon dioxide diffuse in, but a lot of fluid leaves as well. It just gets forced out, right? And at the end of the capillary, the distal end of the capillary, the pressure is decreased, right? So there's high pressure here, low pressure. So there's low pressure at the distal end of a capillary. Some of that tissue fluid then gets pushed back in to this capillary. It's returned to the vascular system, but not all of it. Some of it is still trapped in the tissue spaces. So if blood is coming in and leaving fluid in the tissue spaces, what's happening to a person's body? It doesn't all get resorbed. What happens to a person's body? If it starts to, it swells up, right? Because that fluid is left between all the cells. All right? And that's part of the job of the lymphatic system. There are vessels in the lymphatic system that can actually absorb all that leftover fluid and return it to the heart. So the lymphatic system you could think of as a circulatory system. Right? It's not on this diagram because, well, it's maybe complicated enough because it's the first one. All right, so that's what we want to look at next. All right, lymphatic system. Composition. It's got fluid, kind of like plasma. Okay, that fluid is what we call lymph. There are cells in different parts of the lymphatic system, maybe in lymph nodes and in other parts like the spleen. We call those lymphocytes. And some of those lymphocytes will leave and go into the blood, and we're going to call that a lymphocyte in blood, right? So there are vessels that contain lymph, and as lymph is flowing through these blood vessels returning back to the cardiovascular system, it's filtered so that pathogens in lymph get removed, and it gets filtered in something we call a lymph node. And then there's something called tonsils in the back of your throat, part of your lymphatic system. It fights infection just like these lymph nodes do. So we're going to look at where these are. You have two pairs and then a single one back in your throat. And your spleen is a lymphatic organ, and the thymus gland. Does anybody remember the thymus gland, where it's located? I'm not sure. We just talked about it very first day of class a long time ago. It's in the It's right in the center, kind of around the aorta, maybe down toward the heart a little bit. What's that center cavity right here? It's part of the thoracic cavity, exactly right. But it's just a little piece of the thoracic cavity. That is the ones lateral are the pleural cavities. The one in the center is called the mediastinum, right? So the thymus gland is in the mediastinum, right smack in the middle. All right, so those are the pieces. And the function, we talked about just a little bit, it maintains fluid balance. It keeps you from swelling up. And that swelling is what we call edema. So every day, about 30 liters of plasma pass out of a capillary, all the capillaries of your body. 30 liters. Who's got a drinking bottle of something? Yeah. Does it say how many liters that is? No. Veronica, how many liters is your bottle right there? 32 ounces. Okay, that looks like not quite a liter. Maybe half a liter. Nobody has a liter bottle in here. Okay, that's okay. So how many of those would leak out of your circulatory system every day? 60 of those things would leak out of your circulatory system every day and get stuck in your tissue spaces, right? So it'd be really huge. Some of that fluid gets returned, but not all of it, right? 27 gets resorbed into a capillary, but 3 liters get left in tissue spaces. So that would be, 6 of those bottles get stuck in your tissue spaces every day. Well, that would be dangerous because you would dehydrate and your blood pressure would drop because that fluid is in the wrong spot. So it's the job of these lymphatic vessels, starting with a capillary, it resorbs that extra 3 liters left, right, and returns it to the circulatory system so that you don't swell up. So if there is damage to a lymphatic vessel, right, or lymph node, what's one of the side effects? Maybe a lymph node has to be removed, or a lymphatic vessel. What's going to happen to that part of the body? Somebody just said it's going to swell up. That's right. The swelling or edema is a side effect of that particular treatment. Okay. Another thing, fat absorption. Usually capillaries absorb things because that's where exchange takes place. So capillaries around the large intestine, small intestine will absorb things, but not fat. Fat doesn't mix with water very well, so it's not absorbed directly into the circulatory system. It's absorbed by a lymph vessel where it's partially processed so that it can be stable in a water environment. Those little capillaries, lymphatic capillaries in your digestive tract that absorb fat are what we call lacteals. When we get to the digestive system, I can show you a picture of a lacteal. But a lacteal is a special little tube that absorbs a fat from your diet. And fat and lymph, kind of a milky white fluid, we call that chyle. And then it gets processed. It gets packaged with other kind of compounds that allow it to dissolve in blood. And then these lymphatic vessels rejoin the circulatory system. All right, a third function of the lymphatic system is a self-defense system, body defense system. Lymph nodes and the spleen, right? These are lymphatic organs. They filter things that flow through them. A lymph node is filtering lymph on its way back to the cardiovascular system. And it contains lymphocytes, which can fight infection, can learn what a bacteria looks like and then develop a response to that bacteria. It can then start to make antibodies, or it can make other kinds of lymphocytes that can directly attack that bacterium. That's what happens in a lymph node. And a spleen filters blood. So a lymph node filters lymph, the spleen filters blood. They contain lymphocytes that can fight infection. So these things become activated when you have an infection. Sometimes we call that germ cell activation. All right, so these are some important organs, but you have also lymphatic tissue all over the body, loaded. Your intestines have lymphatic tissue, have nodes within the wall of the intestines, right? You have tonsils, which are lymphatic tissue. The spleen is lymphatic tissue. So that lymphatic tissue that we find all over the body, but not in a lymph node, we call that mucosa-associated lymphoid tissue. So when we say mucosa, we mean like it's a tissue, it's a part of a tissue, right? It's almost like a layer within the intestine. And there's lymphatic tissue in there, and we just call that MALT, M-A-L-T. And it's loaded with vast quantities of lymphocytes, And this malt frequently is a part of a mucous membrane someplace, like the digestive tract, respiratory, urinary tract, reproductive tracts, all contain these germinal centers. When they become activated, when a bacteria is there, they can develop antibodies against that particular bacterium. All right, so what does that sort of look like? Okay, so here are the lymphatic organs. Here's the thymus and the mediastinum. Here are the tonsils in your oral cavity and maybe in your pharynx. Here are some lymph nodes in the intestines. And then here is the appendix. Oh, I didn't mention the appendix. The very end of the large intestine is no longer used for digestion, so it has shrunk down, but the lymphatic tissue that's found in the wall of the intestine, that's what we call malt everywhere, right, still exists in the appendix, so the appendix is there in us to fight infection if you still have your appendix. Right, and there's a tiny, tiny little space in there, and if some digesting food gets into that space, right, it can be infected, and that's what we call appendicitis. And some of you might have had an appendicitis, and then that thing is just removed. Anybody have an appendicitis, or do we all have our appendix in here? Anybody have their appendix removed? That's good. Okay. And then over here is the spleen. So what does this malt look like? So here is an example of a digestive tube. And it looks like small intestine to me, has these ribs in it. So let's focus in on this one little piece and magnify it. Right? I can't quite see cells, so it's not extreme magnification, but I see some structures in the wall of the intestine. We call these follicles, and these follicles are filled with lymphocytes, and they can become activated if there's a microorganism that's pathogenic and tries to get into your body. So these follicles then become activated and develop an immune response by producing antibodies and contact killer cells to fight that infection. And you have that where? Everywhere in your intestines, right? And you have these follicles in your respiratory tract, reproductive tract, right, all over. And since it's just disseminated all over, we just call that malt. Okay, so what does germination mean? Why do we call this a germinal center? That's probably something we should talk about. Germinal center makes perfect sense to me. Maybe once you think about it, it will make perfect sense to you. What does germinate mean? Probably not too much in a animal class. It makes more sense in a plant class, like a botany class. That's how I think of germination. Okay. Yeah, germinal center has certain kind of cells that can become other kinds of cells. So you kind of think of them as stem cells. They can become other kinds of cells. Right, so a stem cell has the ability to become, for instance, muscle or nervous tissue or connective tissue or whatever. Okay, but when I think of a plant and germination, I think of a seed. Right, and you can store a seed for 100 years. I don't know, maybe even 1,000 years. Right, but it's just dormant. And if you take that seed and put it in the right environment, like a warm environment with some moisture, something's going to happen to that seed. It's not going to stay dormant. What's going to happen? It's going to grow. That process of turning into a seed into a growing plant is what we call germination. All right, so germination is when a seed turns into a plant. And what can you tell me about the size of a seed and the size of a plant? Are they the same? No, which is bigger? Yeah, the plant is a lot bigger, right? So germination also kind of means that there are cells that are dividing, right? First you have one and then two. That's what we call proliferation. So that's why we call this a germinal center, because it's quiet when you don't have an infection, but when you are infected, right, these cells start to duplicate, right? They start to grow. They proliferate and produce a lot of antibodies. That's their job. So they do get bigger when somebody has an infection. And we have these germinal centers in lymph nodes as well. So when somebody has a sore throat, for instance, maybe a physician will palpate your neck and he's feeling for these lymph nodes, because if you have an infection, they become activated and they start to grow. They get bigger. So that's one way to kind of track the progress of an infection. Is it localized or is it more systemic? Is it in your lymphatic system or is it not? All right, so a germinal center is just a growing center. It starts to grow when it's activated. It gets activated by foreign substances that enter your body. We just call those antigens. It could be a bacteria, it could be fungus, it could be virus. Yeah.
I have a question. When you have an infection in your throat,
yeah. Ah, okay. Yeah. Yeah. Why does it go up? Why does it go not down? Because gravity's going
to
pull it down. Yes. And you're going to see why as soon as I tell you. It's a really easy answer. Because what connects your throat with your middle ear? There's a tube. There's a tube that's open all the time unless you have an infection. And that's called the Eustachian tube. Does that ring a bell? Auditory tube or the pharyngotympanic tube. So there's a pathway right there. So it's very easy, especially in young people. All right, so young people have an infection of the middle ear. It's called otitis media. And usually it just travels right up the Eustachian tube. And when they have otitis media or a sore throat, that Eustachian tube gets inflamed and closes off, so they can't equalize pressure in their middle ear anymore. So if you go up in the mountains or take an airplane ride or something like that, then their ears hurt really, really bad, right? Because that Eustachian tube is blocked. Yeah. Okay. And there's not a lot of blood vessels inside the tube, so it might be. And there's not a lot of blood vessels in that cavity that we call the middle ear. So sometimes it's really hard to fight that infection because you can't get antibiotics to it so easily. Yeah. Does that sort of make sense? Yeah, that sort of makes sense. Okay. It'd be nice if we had some nice. A lot of lymphatic tissue along that Eustachian tube. We have some, right? We have some because we have, but we have these tonsils right here. So that sort of helps. Okay. I forgot where I was. Oh, we're talking about just germinal centers. Okay. So these are just centers that are very localized in some parts of your body, like the spleen and lymph nodes. Right, but and the appendix right here, but you have these follicles all over your body. So there are follicles that can fight infection almost everywhere in your body. So, for instance, if you lose your appendix right here because it gets inflamed and it has to be removed, you don't really suffer a deficit in immune response because all of the other lymphatic tissue in your body takes over the job. And that's really easy to do. Right. And the spleen, right here. Some people lose their spleens due to trauma. And again, it's an important lymphatic vessel. It has to be removed. And you might say, oh, well, gee whiz, you're going to be more susceptible to infection after a splenectomy. But in most cases, the lymphatic tissue in all other places of the body take over, and there's really no consequence to that. Only under certain circumstances where somebody is at a high risk of infection. Does anybody think of a condition where somebody's at a really high risk of infection? AIDS, yeah, because their immune response is way depleted already. So they're susceptible. But for instance, maybe if you need a hip replacement and you need to put in a prosthetic hip, right, a metal hip, any kind of surgery, you're at risk for infection, but especially if some foreign object is placed in your body, it's really easy to get an infection. So, people that have a splenectomy, you really have to consider, should we replace a joint or not? Or at least be aware of it, because then they're at a much higher risk of an infection, a post-surgical infection as a result. So it pretty much is a good idea to keep your spleen as long as you can in case you have to put some kind of prosthetic device, even a screw someplace. If you break a bone, screws or something like that, there's a high risk of infection for that. Okay. All right, those are the germinal centers. So, let's look. How does lymph start? Here is kind of a nice circulatory pattern. Here's your heart, right? Here's a red artery. Oh, what's a red artery? Systemic or pulmonary circulation? Systemic circulation. Here's a blue vein. Again, systemic circulation. So, remember we said that fluid gets trapped in these tissue spaces and you would swell up. We call that edema, but that tissue fluid then gets transported back, right, toward the heart, and we can see it emptying into the subclavian vein right here. That's where it gets returned. But as it's returned to the heart, it goes through a number of lymph nodes, right? So pathogens get filtered out. So I see one node, two nodes. Before this lymph gets back to the heart, it has to go through at least one lymph node, and sometimes many. I see two in this particular case. And Also on this diagram, you see that a lymph vessel is a lot like a vein. Can you tell me why a lymph vessel is a lot like a vein and not like an artery? It's short. It kind of looks like it shares something that the heart has too. It goes back to the heart. It has, I think I heard, it has a valve. That's right. So veins have valves, and so do lymphatic vessels. So here I see a valve. Right. And because there's very low pressure in lymph, and we need these valves, because if this is a lymphatic vessel in a muscle, when a muscle contracts, it squishes this lymph. It can't go retrograde. It can only go in the forward direction back to the heart, because that's the only direction that that valve allows it to go, right, through these lymph nodes. All right, but how does that work? How does fluid get into a lymphatic vessel? Well, here I see an arteriole. See a nice capillary bed, and of course all capillary beds are leaky. And then here is a venule, going to bring blood back to the heart. We got a lot of fluid left in these tissue spaces. You see these cells right here? In between the cells you have fluid, interstitial fluid. And when it accumulates, it enters like this little dead end right here of a lymphatic vessel. And now it's in the lymph, and it flows back to the heart because there are valves that don't allow it to flow backwards. All right, so these are what we call, so here I see a blood capillary, right? This little network right here. This little dead end right here is what we call a lymphatic capillary. Right, so it's a dead end that can absorb fluid. So how on earth does that work? Here's a pretty good example. We zoom right in to the tip of one of these lymphatic capillaries, and there is something that almost acts like a valve. Right? There's a little flap, and this little flap can open up when you're using certain muscles, and then the fluid can just move in by pressure into this region right here, and then the valve closes, this little flap right here closes, and when you contract that muscle, then the lymph in this area is going to get pushed up toward the heart. So, and again, this is just a nice simple endothelium, simple squamous epithelium. All right, so it's got these mini valves at the end of a lymph capillary. That's how lymph gets into the lymphatic system. And it's going to move away. So here we see, right, the lymphatic system, and we see a whole, sometimes there's an aggregation of lymph nodes, right, like in the axial region. So that can be palpated, right, pretty easy to see if these lymph nodes are activated. What can activate these lymph nodes? What is the way we want to talk about that? What activates these lymph nodes? It starts them growing, starts these germinal centers into growing. Yeah, an infection. And one way that we talk about that infection is we just call it an antigen. Right? And that antigen could be any kind of foreign substance. Could be a bacteria, could be a virus, right? And maybe even a harmful chemical compound could be called an antigen. And so where else? We have cervical nodes, axillary nodes, inguinal nodes. All right? And then it flows back to the heart. And if it's in the lower extremities, it flows into the cisterna cavae and then into the thoracic duct and then back to the subclavian vein. And you notice that this is kind of, this guy has kind of a weird color right here. All right? So the whole left side of his body and the lower extremity is all one color. Is that true? Is this the same color as this over here? Yes. Okay. Well, I just noticed that it seems to be a little bit darker. Probably should be the same color. Well, anyway, so this region right here that is this color, the whole left side and most of the right side of the body, drained back to the thoracic duct that we have right here. But the right side of the head and the right upper appendage and the right chest don't go into the thoracic duct. They go into this vessel right here. Okay? And we just call this the lymphatic duct. And that drains back to the subclavian artery as well. So the circulatory pattern of the lymphatic system is not purely symmetrical like we see in other parts of the body. That's why we have this color pattern right here. So kind of strange. Okay, so what do we want to see? We want to take a look at some of these lymph nodes. What's the job of this lymph node? So here is a lymph node. Here is a lymph vessel bringing lymph to a node. I see a nice arrow right here, and I see a valve. For sure, the lymph is going to come in this direction. Can't go backwards. And we're going to call these afferent lymphatic vessels. Afferent means entry. So these vessels allow entry of lymph into the lymph node. And then after lymph goes through the lymph node, it leaves through these efferent vessels. Right, so kind of use your understanding of how the central nervous system works. What kind of nerve brings information into the brain? That's an afferent. And what kind of nerve takes information away from the brain? That is an efferent. So it's the same scheme right here. And you can take a look by the how these valves are located. We see some structures inside a lymph node. All right, and lymph is going to just percolate through all these different cells and spaces. And so there are some subspaces made by this connective tissue that we call trabeculae. So I see like a little room over here and over here and over here and over here. And in these rooms, we have follicles. So here we have a lymphoid follicle, another lymphoid follicle. And inside that follicle, we have a germinal center. So these are the lymphatic cells that can recognize an infection. And when they do, they figure out a way to kill that bacteria, and then they start to grow and proliferate and share that information with other kinds of lymphocytes. And also on the periphery, right, we have the sinus, right? And the sinus is just a space that collects lymph. So lymph actually percolates through all of these areas, but it's this germinal center within a follicle that is really doing the job for us. And lymph filters, so this makes up the cortex, the trabeculae, the germinal center, right, and the sinus, and then that lymph flows into the, what do we call the inner part of an organ? Medulla, yeah. So here we have medulla cords and sinuses, and again, there's some germinal centers in these things before that lymph leaves via a efferent lymph vessel. All right, so when this system becomes activated by, what does it become activated by?
Infection.
Yeah, what do we call that? Antigen. Yeah, antigen. More molecular understanding, right, instead of a cellular understanding. So think more molecular and antigen. Then these cells start to grow, right? That's proliferation. But when they start to grow, you could also kind of think of that as germination, right? Okay. And then, like around most organs here, is a fibrous capsule around the lymph node. Okay, so that's a lymph node. Another important organ is the spleen. So here's a spleen. And we said that the spleen filters things. It can filter blood and it can filter lymph. When it filters blood, it's going to get rid of old and damaged blood cells. That's one of its jobs. Or maybe if somebody's low on red blood cells, the spleen can actually add some red blood cells to the circulation. That's done in one part of the spleen. But lymph also flows through the spleen, and it gets filtered. And it gets filtered. What gets filtered out in the spleen if it's in the lymph that shouldn't be there? What do we call those things? You could say infection, but I want you to think molecular. It's an antigen. That's right. So the spleen filters antigens out of lymph. So let's look at a little bit more microscopic level of the spleen. Here's an illustration of the spleen, almost microscopic, but not quite. All right, so I see some white areas here, and I see some red areas. All right, well, fortunately, this is easy to tell. The red areas filter blood, and the white areas right here, right, the white pulp filters lymph. So where do I have that? Spleen. All right, so red pulp filters blood, white pulp filters lymph, but also filters some blood of, in particular, pathogens. So the red lymph doesn't filter for pathogens or antigens, but the white pulp does. Now, the basic tissue type of a spleen, let's think of some connective tissues. What's a really strong fiber that you're aware of, that we find in connective tissue? Yeah, collagen is the strongest. What's the next not so strong? Okay. But it's nice because you can stretch it and let go, goes back, that's elastic. And then what's the weakest, by far the weakest? Yeah, reticular, right? And that's hardly worth anything because it's so weak. So the spleen is made up of a reticular fibers, not collagen. So is it strong or is it weak? It is weak, right? So it's easily traumatized by any kind of blunt force trauma. It's going to rip because it doesn't have collagen. And when it rips, you can see that it is it highly vascular or not very many blood vessels? Do you see any blood vessels in the spleen? A lot of blood vessels. That's right. So when it gets lacerated or ripped, right, there is severe bleeding as a result of that, right? So the spleen hemorrhages very, very easily due to trauma. Well, if you have a laceration on your skin and you're bleeding, and you want that skin to grow back together, what can you do with a nice laceration on your skin? Yeah, you just stitch it up because you have a lot of collagen fibers right there. No collagen in the spleen, so if you want to suture the spleen, maybe to stop the bleeding and bring these margins of that laceration back together, no collagen, just by placing a suture, that's going to cause more ripping, which then causes what? More hemorrhage. All right, and then you could proceed and keep that process going, but you're always going to produce more trauma. So the only way, right, to protect somebody from bleeding out is actually to tie a knot around these major arteries and veins in a spleen and then remove that whole part of the spleen. And so if somebody has a damaged and bleeding spleen, you try to remove just the part that's bleeding and keep the part that's still healthy. A lot of times that can't be done, in which case then the whole spleen has to be removed. But first, what you got to do? Tie off these blood vessels, right, to stop the hemorrhage. Okay, so you can't suture a spleen because it's just not strong enough. It has a lot of blood vessels. Typically, a blood clot doesn't form fast enough or in enough places to stop a major hemorrhage and probably death after that. Yeah, okay. And these blood vessels probably won't regenerate either. It will just become a scar. It will become connective tissue. So after you take the blood supply away, it can't regenerate itself. Okay, the last organ is the thymus gland, and you kind of know where the thymus gland is located, in the mediastinum, and it's a place where there is a certain kind of lymphocyte goes to gain what we call competence. It can become active, and it's called a T lymphocyte. A T lymphocyte doesn't make molecules that kills antigens. We call those antibodies or molecules that can fight antigens, for instance, like bacteria. But there's another way your body can fight infection, and that is by making a cell, when it bumps into a bacteria, it will grab onto the bacteria and then secrete compounds that will break the bacterium apart. We call that lysis. And so we call those contact killers, and they are T lymphocytes. They're a lymphocyte that has now evolved to be a contact killer, but it physically has to actually contact that pathogen in order to lyse it and kill it. And the job of the thymus is to make sure that these T lymphocytes, right, mature properly so that they can be good contact killers or gain competence. All right, so that's the lymphatic system. We're going to talk more about these tonsils when we get to digestive system. You're going to see where they are. But that's good for today. Oh, what's next? What are we going to talk about next?